Welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast, where frontline sales leaders teach you how to build and scale an outbound sales team. Hey, everybody. Today, we're joined by a guest that I've been looking forward to for a few months now. He runs this invite-only sales community that I somehow managed to sneak an invite into. And I think one of the reasons that I've been really excited to have our guest on today is that he started his life in product management. And we all know that there's been this gap between sales and marketing for a long time that we've slowly been repairing. But I think there's this invisible bridge between sales and product that's missing. And there's not a ton of people that are talking about it, except for Pete. Today we've got Pete Kazanji. He sold his company. He started off in product management, built TalentBin to how many people, Pete, before you guys got bought?
I think the company was 40 folks. We had 20 reps when we were acquired by Monster.
Mm-hmm. And then once you got acquired to Monster, you supersized the team and you were helping with new product sales of a sales force that was 600 people?
Yeah. So TalentBin was acquired by Monster. We're then responsible for new product sales because they had acquired a number of other products as well. And then, the Monster sales organization in the United States was 600 folks. In Europe, it was 500.
Awesome.
So a little different size scale.
Perfect. So everybody meet Pete Kazanji. Pete, meet everybody.
What's up, everybody?
Hi, Pete.
Hey, Pete.
Let's rewind to a little bit before the Monster acquisition. You were talking about how predictable revenue saved you, and then in some ways it actually got you into trouble. Can you elaborate what you meant by that?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it was necessarily into trouble. Like, I think that my background, as you were alluding to, is in product management, product marketing. I worked at a company called VMware before I started TalentBin. And when we started TalentBin, it was one of those situations where it was me and my co-founder, Jason, and some engineers. And it was like one of those things where it was like, okay, now you have to go and sell this. And so, and that kind of fell to me, and I had never, right? Like, hey, you like to talk on the phone, and by the way, you don't code, so guess what your job is?
Default.
Default. We started doing that, and at the time, there actually just wasn't a lot of kind of like documentation of like sales, enterprise sales, or B2B sales for dummies. There was predictable revenue, which was like a godsend for me. And also, we were in First Round Capital as an investor of ours. And so they have a very good CEO community. And so I was able to lean on a bunch of other founders and CEOs who had come from a sales background or kind of gone up that path before. But eventually we figured it out. We ended up, I was our first rep and then our first sales manager, then our VP of sales. And then we were acquired by Monster as responsible for new product sales there. And so, but all on the way kind of have really been paying attention to what that process looks like what the difference between early selling is and where the mistakes were, which we made tons, at TalentBin and early selling, and then how that changes as you go to a little bit later on where you have a handful of reps to where you have, a dozen reps and so on and so forth. And so I think one of the things that we ran into early on when I was reading predictable revenue, for instance, was like, oh my gosh, there's this like fabulous magic thing where we can, get appointments on the calendar and demo our product and potentially sell it to folks without thinking like, oh, is this ideal customer profile though? Or are these folks necessarily, like, they may give us $10,000 for a seat of the software, but are they going to get value out of it now? At our stage and our level of capitalization over the lifetime of the company, we only raised about $3 million. It was kind of one of those things where like, hey man, their money's green. Let's take it because we can, we can pay payroll with it. But it really had me start thinking about that, especially in retrospect after we started realizing what the mistakes were and we started fixing them. But then as I started advising and investing in more startups after the Monster acquisition, started seeing these patterns again and again of early stage founders who kind of don't know what they're doing with respect to sales, which you kind of makes sense, right? Like, it's totally okay. Like, you come out of a consulting background or out of a finance background or out of,
You're passionate about the product and the vision.
Yeah.
No, you haven't had a sales job before.
Exactly. And so what's fascinating, what I kind of realized in retrospect was, oh, well, like if you think about where salespeople come from, you know, you graduate from college, you go through an SDR program, maybe, or go through, you know, sales training at like Xerox or ADP or what have you, and you learn how to sell. There wasn't really like much of that curriculum, if you will, for like a 30-year-old who, or like a 28-year-old who's just like graduated from business school and is like now starting to work on things. And so that's what I ended up kind of thinking, like, oh, okay, I should probably write this down because I just was this guy. And, you know, I have a lot of these mistakes, and I've now seen the solutions, and I've seen these patterns with other folks. So I should just write this down, and we'll call it founding sales. And Aaron says I need to have a public deadline because having a sign-up page on foundingsales.com is not sufficient right now. So I'm going to do that after this podcast.
I mean, we are public now. We could put you on the spot.
I know, right?
So the transition, that sort of that pre-predictable revenue piece, I think the one piece that really of your content that really resonated with me was about the sales imperatives. Mm-hmm. Can you maybe share with the audience, like why are those important, and like where do we start?
Yeah. So I think that a lot of the times what founders will screw up, or like non-sellers and sellers can screw this up too. Mark Roberge has this great phrase that he talks about like the show up and throw up, where you're just like, and then you've got this feature, and then here's this feature, and then here's this feature. And the prospect's like, what does this matter to me? And I think you get the same thing going on with founders or technologists, where they're like, I've made this thing. It's so neat, exciting, right? And I want to show it to you without thinking about it from the standpoint of, like, what's the problem it's trying to solve? What's the pain that the user cares, that the problem?
It uses AI.
It's, oh my God, it's got big data and AI.
And machine learning.
Yeah, exactly. Without kind of like dialing it all the way back and being like, this thing makes your life easier by making leads automatically follow, like show up in your, you know, in your CRM. It's called HubSpot. Right? Or this thing makes your life super easy by making it such that you never have to have that awkward moment at the beginning of a sales presentation where they're downloading GoToMeeting or WebEx or whatever. It's called ClearSlide or what. And like, those are kind of very basic examples, like starting with benefits. But what oftentimes what folks will do is they have the features and they like regale people with them because they haven't actually like written down specifically, like, what is the problem I'm trying to solve? What is the biggest, like, what are the costs associated with that product, that problem? Who has that problem? And doing that in a methodical fashion. It's part like product management and it's part product marketing.
Yep. Plus, also I think what people miss is, how does that person think about that problem in their language rather than my language?
Yeah, exactly. And so it's the I just call it a sales narrative, where really it's a story. And you know, I think some of the best salespeople have good stories. But knowing what that is ahead of time and like methodically mapping it out is a great way of setting yourself up for success. And so it's one of the chapters in Founding Sales is saying like, hey, before you go and say, oh, I need a sales deck or I need a demo video or what have you, what you should probably do is dial all the way back and say, actually, I should probably get my story straight first and know, hey, what is the actual problem? Who has it? And does it change based on their persona, right? Because like, Aaron, you worked at Salesforce, right? If I recall correctly.
Yep.
Yeah.
For 4 years back when it was small.
Yeah, exactly. So like, you know, the who has the problem that Salesforce solves is different predicated on whether it's a rep or a manager or a sales operations person. So, you know, who has the problem and what maybe what are the different ones depending on who it is, right? The persona, like what the costs are associated with it, how people currently fix it and why that sucks. So like, to use Salesforce as an example, you know, why Siebel is insufficient for this, or why like it ACT contact management or what have you local on a desktop is not sufficient. What has changed to enable the new solution. That's something that kind of VCs care about, but I also think it's very helpful to understand that in the context of selling as well, because it provides the prospect a means by which to understand, like, oh, okay, that's the current way that we do things or probably do things, but here's this new enabling thing that allows me to rethink how I should go about, you know, content marketing or lead generation or CRM or what have you. And then how it works. And then importantly, and this is where, again, founders will kind of mess this up, qualitative and quantitative proof that the solution is better. Because it can't just be like, and then there's this feature, and then there's this feature, and then there's this feature. It has to be, oh, and by the way, the reason why you want HubSpot is because it's going to raise your MQLs per month by 50%, and given your average contract value, that's going to lift you $30,000 a month in revenue. By the way, we cost $5,000. Right. Having that all together, it sets you up for success for everything that kind of cascades after that. So if you have that narrative lined out, you can make a really great sales deck.
Yep. I think part of the question for people is people talk about it. When people say, well, how do I get that narrative? Besides sitting down and just trying to write it out, like, how do I get a useful or accurate or maybe useful narrative versus my theory that I have in my brain? Yeah. Especially if I'm a founder who hasn't talked with lots of prospects in the sales kinds of conversation where you're used to trying to get into their, empathy is probably one of the number one sales skills. You're putting yourself in their shoes to think like them.
Yep.
How do you do that?
Yeah. And that's awesome, because one of the things I think that really sets you well up for success to create that sales narrative, like, it can't be created in a vacuum. One of the ways you do that is by having done very good customer research from the get-go. So one of the things, like, so Eric Ries talks about this in Lean Data, and Steve Blank talks about this in Startup Owner's Manual. There's also a really good article on First Round Review called Get in the Van. It's by this guy named Michael Sippy, who used to be a product leader at Twitter. It talks about going and doing good product research ahead of time. And this is just product management work. So you go and you approach folks and say, like, hey, how do you attract customers to your website to register right now? Oh, well, the way I do that is by, like, blogging, but then, you know, getting distribution on it is really hard. And then, you know, people come inbound, but then I can't, you know, I have to manually email them every couple of weeks or what have you. Oh, okay, cool. Interesting. Well, what if we had a means by which you could, like, blog really easily and it could get distributed very easily across all your social properties and other things, and maybe even pay for distribution as well. And then when people registered, you could then drip them over time with a bunch of that content. Oh yeah, that sounds really awesome. Yeah, so this is this thing called HubSpot. We're thinking about building it. And so if you have dozens and dozens and dozens of those conversations, you start seeing patterns around what those pain points are, such that then you can then build product against it. And then when you get to the sales narrative, really what you're just doing is, like, recounting that tale of, like, when we talk to all these different folks, everyone says that, you know, following up with their customers and nurturing them is a huge pain in the ass. So what we did was we went and we built this feature over this thing over here called HubSpot Drip Marketing, and it solves problems like this. So that's how you make sure that it's real, is by having that empathy up front. And so I think if you, if you're not in charge of that product management thing and you kind of show up after the fact and, like, the product's already baked, then it involves getting into the shoes of the prospect and seeing how they're reacting to it. And then, like, kind of maybe tweaking things. And if things aren't resonating, then that kind of has to get piped back into product. Mm-hmm. Right. Cause so, like, if the product is literally not resonating with folks, then, you know, us having a sexy sales narrative is not super helpful, because we could sell it, but then they're probably not going to get value out of it, and they're going to churn out anyway.
Yeah. It's the same if you don't have a great product, no matter how great your email template is, and no matter how many times you call them, no matter how many times how great your process is, it's just not you know, if the end goal is to help somebody with this product and you don't have the product isn't great, or you don't quite understand that, it's going to be quite challenging to actually go on and communicate that to a potential customer that doesn't know the product as well as you.
Yeah. And then even if you have success and you get in a buy and it doesn't work, yeah, then that's going to be a problem as well. And then that's why I shared this deck with Colin a while back on sales maturity stages, where, you know, it's just like it's a stepwise process where, you know, you want to start and understand, does this technology actually solve the problem? Well, first you want to understand that people actually have the problem, because most of the time startups kill themselves by solving a problem that doesn't exist. Instead, someone just kind of like thinks, hey, wouldn't it be cool if this, as opposed to going and having those empathetic conversations with folks and saying, hey, you know, how do you know whether or not your sales reps are tracking towards success on their quotas? Oh, you know, I don't. Or we have these weekly calls and it super sucks and it's so much of a pain in the ass. Okay, well, what if we had this like magical cloud-based CRM where people could track their opportunities in there, and then you as a manager could see it, have better access. Oh, actually, yeah, that does sound cool. Like, I do have that problem and that sounds like it potentially could be a solution. And then you go and build it, and then you have to actually see, does it solve that problem? Mm-hmm. And so first validate that the problem actually exists, then see, does the product that you built actually solve the problem? It could be beginnings of it where it's like early sparks, right? It doesn't have to be like perfect out of the box, but we want to see that actually is starting to address that problem. And then the next step, of course, is like, can we sell it? And the next step after that is, can we sell a lot of it? And then the next step after that is, can somebody other than me sell it? And then you're kind of off to the races, right? But like, if you jump to like stage six, mm-hmm, you know, can we sell a lot of it and lots of people sell it? You might end up in a situation where like you have air under you. And I think we've seen some pretty big, you know, flameouts recently. Like, you know, Zenefits is a great example. There's been a number of others where you kind of jump to premature scale without actually validating, does this thing actually solve the problem that we're seeking to solve? Do people get value out of it? I think this is why folks are so focused on customer success, and kind of like one of the things that VCs are super focused on is like net negative churn, because it's a good indicator that people are getting value. But you can do that even without having like, you know, 50 or 100 or 200 customers by which to measure net negative churn, by understanding at a very small scale, is this solving the problem that we set out to solve, by like asking them or looking at their usage or what have you. You kind of have to do that first.
That's a great point. And I really like your framework, and I'd love, because I think a lot of the companies that I've run into or have founded or been a part of, you know, you might get part of it right out of the gate, but maybe you don't. Could you like, I know your framework is like, what's the problem, who has the problem, et cetera, but why don't we start with like, what is the problem, right? Like for all those salespeople and like sales dev managers, sales leaders that are out there that are listening right now, let's say you haven't got this information from your product team. Okay, we're probably not going to be able to take 3 months and get super deep and just go interview 90 customers. But there probably is a sort of abbreviated version of it that that the sales leaders can take on, or the salespeople if they're in that situation. Can we maybe just walk through it sort of a high level? Like, let's start with, what is the problem? What are some of the things that we can do to sort of identify and address?
Well, ideally, depending on the size of the organization, you'd want to make sure that, or you should be able to get this from product management, or because they literally built a product to solve this problem, right? And if they didn't, we've got bigger problems. Yeah. But frequently what will happen, I see this kind of failure mode happen a lot too, where you have sales organizations who haven't been sufficiently enabled with materials and what have you. And it's not because the product team doesn't know the problem that they're solving. It's just it's baked into the software, like the problem and also the solution is baked into the software, and it hasn't been like written down in text, right? Or turned into pictures or what have you. So probably the first thing you could do if you feel that you don't have this, like if you feel that you as a sales leader or a sales rep don't have a good handle on like what the problem is that the product is solving, then you should be able to go to product management and say, hey, we should, can we get like an hour on the calendar and document this? Because the product manager or whoever is functioning as that, maybe it's the founder of the company or what have you, they're typically functioning as the voice of the customer inside the organization. And so that would be the place to kind of start there. Now, if the answers there maybe aren't right, and you know this because then when you take like the product management or leadership says, hey, these are the problems we think that we're solving, and then you turn to the customer and say and have that conversation, they say, no, that's actually not what's going on there. Mm-hmm. Well, then probably the product doesn't fit the market, right? And so that information needs to be brought back to the product org in order to say like, yeah, we keep going and talking to these customers and saying like, hey, we think you have this problem right here, or we go through discovery in order to figure out whether they have this problem, and lo and behold, they keep saying they don't. So my recommendation would be, in the scenario where you don't feel that you have a good handle on this, go to product management and see if you can get this, you know, get this documented by working together. And largely you should be able to kind of do that across the entire narrative framework, because not only should product management be able to say, you know, what is the problem, who has it, and what are the costs associated, like they should have the answers to all those questions, mm-hmm. because that's literally what should have legitimated the engineering investment to build the product. And then if they don't have that, or if some of those answers are like bouncing off the customer's foreheads, then that needs to come back into product management so you can actually have a product that resonates.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think like we've run into a couple organizations that just, they might not have a product management function. They might have, you know, maybe they did in the early days and that person's not there. Maybe it was the founder and they grew up and now it's been, grew up into the CEO or whatever. And now it's been, you know, years since somebody's done this. So if an individual like sales leader or salesperson had to go out and like, let's pretend there's no sales, let's pretend there's no product management org.
Right.
How do we do like the abbreviated version of this? Like, can we walk through each of the steps and just say, you know,
That's really interesting. I mean, that's an interesting question. Let's think about that. So like, my first recommendation would be, who would be the alternative proxy for that in the organization, whether it's the CEO or what have you, maybe it's like the CTO or engineering or what have you. But if that's not there, okay, I can totally see that. So then maybe the way that you could then go and backform this and kind of like rediscover it would be by probably engage, my hypothesis there would be by engaging with your best customers, mm-hmm. and kind of understand like, okay, cool. Like you bought and you're still around and you keep renewing and you're high NPS or what have you, or like you're the best of our best. Like, whoa, what is the problem that you've hired our product to solve? Right. And like, you know, who are you? Yeah. And who are the other people whose problems this solves in your organization? And you know, cause I think then essentially what you're doing is you're kind of doing customer research in reverse, mm-hmm. after the product has already been deployed. So I think that could be like a good way of going about that. And your CS apparatus could probably help you with that for sure.
Gotcha. And so the steps are basically like, you know, what is the problem that we're solving for you? What is the job? Is that Clay Christensen? And is it like milkshake video?
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So what is the problem? Who has this? You know, what are some of the costs associated? I mean, it's basically, you can go back to your existing customer base and go through your same sort of checklist here, right?
Yeah, you totally. I'm looking at it right now. I can totally imagine you doing that. Like, you know, what is the problem that you've hired us to solve? How's that working out? You know, who are the other folks in the organization who I'm like, you should probably see that by who's using it. And then like, what was the prior way that this was being done? Mm-hmm. Like, oh, okay, this is like some fancy reporting solution. And how did you guys used to do like forecast roll up before you deployed, you know, top ops or whatever? Oh, we did it this way. It was such a pain in the butt. It took this amount of time and it was always super inaccurate. Okay, cool. And like, you know, how much time does it take now? It's almost like, you know, the formation of like customer success stories when you read like case studies and things like that.
Yeah.
Usually what those are is those are kind of like point examples of like your sales narrative. It's usually framed as like problem, solution, outcomes. Like if you go to any organization's, you know, customer success stories, usually like larger organizations like a HubSpot or a NetSuite or something like that, and you read through theirs, usually what will happen is they'll be focused on specific types of customers. Like, this is a customer success story about a mid-market finance company. And then it has like the problem, the solution, the outputs, like, you know, the ROI and what have you. But if you have enough of those, that kind of, as it then like generalizes, that points to what that sales narrative is.
Gotcha.
Cool.
I'm thinking back to all the, you know, I haven't worked for a venture backed startup myself. So my experience is a little bit more broad, but worked for some large publicly traded companies and some small mom and pop shops. Maybe let's sort of switch gears and can you walk, take us back to your, that sort of sales maturity ladder? Cause I think that was the other sort of piece that really stood out, and we can share that maybe with your permission, you know, after this article and just as a way of identifying like, where are the soft spots in your story or the soft spots in your sort of our understanding as a sales team?
Yeah. It's like, let me just bring that up.
Yeah, it's like, how do you troubleshoot yourself?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, totally. And I think that like you guys probably talk about this a little bit in, you know, from impossible to inevitable, but the stages I like to talk about in like founder-led selling, I call it founder-led selling, but it's just kind of like early stage evangelical selling. Ideally, the founder is probably doing it first, because if you bring on a bunch of sales reps or even like some sales reps before you even know it can be sold, like it's going to be tough to have somebody who's not super intimate with the product and the problem selling this to start. So that's why I recommend that founders start out as the initial sellers. But usually what it is, it's like, hey, we have to have an existence proof of value creation. Like we have to know that it actually works, because and we have to be able to see that the product is impacting the KPIs that we set out to solve. So like early HubSpot, for instance, if you have it deployed at some beta customers and it's like drip marketing people and nurturing people, but they're actually not responding, or you know, there's other problems, well, the solution doesn't work. Right. So like, that's kind of the first step, is before we can actually ask somebody to give us value, like cash in exchange for the value we're delivering them, like the value actually has to be created first. So knowing what that is, and then knowing that you have like demonstrable proof of that is the first stage. The next stage, of course, is like, will somebody pay? After that, it's will many people pay? Because early on, and I think this goes to the point of predictable revenue, is, you know, will a small group of people pay? Yeah. Like, you're the founder, you're the early, you know, salesperson, you have a network of folks, and you can kind of cobble together enough prospects to get to, you know, 10 or 20 or what have you. But let's actually, like, that's not going to prove that we can scale this thing. So we want to prove that at a like statistically significant level that many people will pay for this, because we want to demonstrate that there's actually a market here before we decide to say, oh, okay, cool, like let's bring a bunch of sales reps in. And so those initial things, like, hey, like, do we know the problem that's being solved here, and do people actually have it? Does the software actually work, or the solution actually work to solve that problem? Will people pay for it? And then like, will more than, you know, a handful of folks pay for that? Those things right there are kind of like clustered together. Like, they're definitely stepwise, right? Because probably not, you know, you're gonna have a hard time getting people to pay for something and sticking around if it actually doesn't work. So you kind of go through those stages right there before you can then move to the next stage, which is like, all right, cool, we've got the beginnings of like a sales motion here. Can I then clone that into somebody else? And that's actually a pretty important point, where the behavior or like the job of the founder seller or that early sales person or early sales manager. That's where that changes, because before what you were doing is like you were baking the sales motion, you're figuring out how to sell this thing. And then now what we're doing is figuring out how we can get somebody else to sell it. Because if we can do that, like once we know the sales motion works because we did it, you know, a dozen times or three dozen times and across like 100 opportunities or what have you. Once we've proven that, now we can say, okay, can I get rep A and rep B to do that? Because then if I know that that can happen, well, at that point now, if I can get one and two reps to do it, I can probably get to 10 or 20 reps to do it. And now that's a real business. And so the important thing right there at the initial, I call it, you know, value exchange specialization and abstraction. So like, you know, getting somebody else who's not the founder to sell that, the job changes from being figuring out how to sell it to making sure that you can get somebody who's not you to sell that. And so that's where getting it out of your head and getting it into materials, whether it's Google documents or slides or demo videos or demo scripts or, you know, writing down what the ideal customer profile is, that's kind of part of the job there, is like getting it out of your head, getting it, like getting this sales motion software that you've been developing as you've been going through this initial selling behavior, getting that out such that somebody else can ingest it, A, and then B, making sure that those folks are ingesting it, mm-hmm. and then being able to action it, right? Like you're writing the play the first time, and now it's like, okay, cool. I'm no longer running this play and doing the actual blocking myself. I'm standing over here, or I'm going to get down in my three-point stance, and I'm going to do the play first, and then I'm going to stand back and say, now you. And then you're going to do it until we've proven that you can do it successfully. And so that's like a very important juncture there where you want to prove that you can do that with one or two, probably, I mean, start with two reps, right? So you can have some competition going on. But if you like jump ahead of that and say, actually, I've sold 10 of these, let's hire 20 reps. That's probably not going to be great, because getting somebody else to sell this thing and like essentially teaching them and being the personal trainer for them, if you're spreading that across 10 people or 20 people, it's very much like boiling the ocean, as opposed to saying like, no, let's really nail this right here for these one or two folks. There's going to be all sorts of like screw ups while you're doing that. But the good news is like now you're baking it's like you're baking a sales management motion as opposed to the sales motion. And you're saying, oh, okay, cool. For the next cohort of reps we bring on, we have to avoid these things right here because they were super confusing or didn't work. Mm-hmm. And, or, oh, we have to have them do these exercises instead, because that's when we finally started doing that with these two reps, that's where they really hit a seam. So that's like a really important kind of like linchpin there, because when you nail that, now you can scale up, because if you can bring on two folks and like you bring on another two folks and like lo and behold, they ramp much more quickly than those initial two folks. Well, now you're in a pretty sweet spot, because you can now potentially parallelize a lot more muscularly. And at that point, like now you're kind of, it's probably a good idea to bring in professional sales management at that point, because like you as a founder can probably move on to something else. But it's getting those initial kind of things set up for success before you hit the gas, mm-hmm. Is important, because if you don't, and you see this again, like, I mean, I don't mean to pick on Zenefits. There's like tons and tons of examples of this, but if you haven't proven that you can do this at small scale with a handful of reps who then get to success and are attending every month or every quarter or what have you, and they're bringing on customers that get to success and don't churn. If you don't do that, what you could potentially be doing is, hey, I'm going to bring on 10 reps, each of whom cost me $10,000 a month. And so now my burn, I've, you know, got $100,000-$150,000 in sales rep burn per month. And I realized 6 months later, like, oh, they actually didn't bring any business in. Well, you probably should have, like, oh, that was a really unpleasant $750,000, like,
whoops.
Yeah, exactly. But So get it tight, you know, before you pour on the gas, right? Like you know, make sure the cylinders are firing correctly before you pour a bunch of gas through there. Because if the engine's pinging and, like, you know, the mixture's too rich or what have you, you know, choose your metaphor or what have you, it's just not good for the organization, and you're gonna burn cash and potentially create your company. Right. So, like, those are kind of the steps there. And what folks what oftentimes do is they, the anti-patterns are trying to jump too far ahead where you actually don't know that it works and you're trying to sell it. Like, that's just going to bite you in the ass because, you know, people will churn out. Your reps won't have success. They're going to leave, et cetera. And that's usually the most common case, is like not doing the work required in order to set these folks up for success. Cause it's hard. It's like, it's actual work. It's so much more easier and attractive to say, oh, let's just like hire 10 reps and they'll figure it out. But the downside of that is like pretty large.
So then all you have to do is hire people instead of actually like engage the brain.
Yeah. But then, like, if you burn, like, you churn through, like, then think about your, like, reps are kind of like customers, right? Yeah. If you hire 10 reps and you fire 5 of them 4 months later, but they were on a draw, like, think how, like, aggressively, like, think how bad that is for your organization. Because, like, you spend all this time and energy to acquire 10 reps, but only 5 ultimately get to success. You paid those recruiting fees. You paid all that. Like, they were working leads. They were working ops. And they didn't get to success. It's just, it's a very inefficient engine. And there's no reason, there's no excuse to do that nowadays, because, like, we should have good sales instrumentation. And if you do a good job of doing the work up front, such that you know that the sales motion does work because you've done it, and then you have it well documented and in a way that other people can ingest it and you can get them to success, this is such a better way of going about things. Because, you know, like, the organization now is just hitting all engines, or all cylinders, excuse me.
Gotcha. Hey, what want to be respectful of everybody's time here. I really appreciate you coming on. One last question on, can you give us an example of one thing that, that the great Pete Kazanji screwed up in the early days of Taliban in building her sales org?
I have to choose one. Are you kidding me? You know, I think that's really where a lot of this stuff has come from, was just me 6 months later looking back at me like, oh my God, that was so dumb. Why did we do that? And then seeing it in companies that I've invested in and be like, ah, you're about to do that thing that I did that was super stupid. Stop that. Right. I think probably the biggest examples I've seen is, like, one, being resistant to selling yourself. Like, just do it. It's not magic. It is a craft that can be learned. There are some people who have natural skills at it, but it's a skill that can be acquired. So first, do it. Second, do it in a stepwise fashion. So actually, like, make sure that you're focused on ideal customer profile folks that are going to get success, that are going to get value out of your product. This is something that's an issue more and more of late, where you have, you have these accelerators like YC, where early on it's great. Everyone's going to sell to each other because then we're going to go to demo day, and lo and behold, oh my God, everyone has so many customers. Look at this customer growth. It's crazy. You know, hey, investors, you should pay up. And then, like, lo and behold, 6 months later, like, all those customers churn out because, like, they weren't getting value out of the solution. So, you know, do the selling yourself. Make sure that you're focused on ideal customer profile, where people will pay, will pay for the value that you're providing them. And then just be intentional about, like, baking that sales motion with the mindset that you got to solve it yourself. But importantly, what you're doing is you're creating, like, a runtime playbook for somebody else eventually. I think those are kind of, like, the biggest thing. So, the reason why I know that those are the good things to do is because at Taliban, occasionally we didn't do that. Like, so for instance, at Taliban, you know, we would get inbound leads where we have VPs of engineering who were coming inbound and saying, hey, I hear that, like, recruiting is really important and I need to hire a bunch of, software engineers. Can you sell us your software? And so we would say, like, yeah, like, we'll totally take $10,000 from you in order to sell the software. The problem was, what we should have said was, cool, how much time are you willing to dedicate per day to hiring or to recruiting? And pretty quickly, you start realizing that a VP of engineering is not going to be spending his or her time sending outbound emails to, you know, to software engineering candidates. Whereas if you're talking to a technical recruiter or a sourcer, then they certainly, that's what their job is. That's all they do all day long, right? And so in that case, it's like, oh, what proportion of your day do you dedicate to passive candidate recruiting? Oh, well, I spend about 3 hours on LinkedIn every day. Okay, cool. Why is that unsatisfying? Well, nobody responds to emails, and you know, the profiles don't have a lot of information on it. Okay, cool. Well, we've got this magic tool that has 5 times the search results of LinkedIn, has personal email addresses, and has drip marketing baked into it as well. It'll cut that time down from 3 hours to like 15 minutes, and you'll get better results. Does that sound good? Yes, take my money, right? So like, that should be the conversation. It should not be the VP of engineering like, oh, you know, I hear that hiring's important, so will you sell this to me? Like, yeah. That was the ideal customer profile problem that we ran into. And it really screwed us when it came time for our Series A, because our SaaS metrics looked terrible, because we had taken all these customers that eventually like didn't get value out of it because they weren't ideal customer profile. So like, I mean, that's just like one screw up, but there's others as well. But if you're intentional about like going through a stepwise methodology to bait your sales motion, you'll avoid those and that'll be good.
Man, that would have saved me like 2.5 years. Where were you in 2011?
It would definitely save us like 12 months. I think we were lost in the desert for 12 months for sure.
Yeah. Steve, can't thank you enough for coming on today.
Yeah, thanks guys.
We're going to share a summary of this post in the show notes. We'll wrap up some of your narrative framework. But can you tell our listeners, where can they find out more about you and about your book that's coming out?
Just Google me. I'm the only Peter Gazanji around. But
if you can spell it.
Yeah. Google will autocorrect it.
Nice.
You can go to foundingsales.com. You can drop your email address in there. You'll get a notification when the book comes out. You can follow us on Twitter as well. Which is this weekend.
Yeah.
This weekend.
Right on. Well, thanks again, Pete. It's been great.
Killer, guys. All right. I'm gonna bounce, okay?
Thanks.
All right, Pete. Thanks, buddy.
Yeah. Bye, Aaron. Good to see you, man.